You're listening to episode 220 of Positively Trek. My name is Barry DeFord, and I'm happy to be joining you all on this wonderful episode I've actually been looking forward to for a very long time. And with me, as always, is Mr. Dan Gunther. How you doing, Dan?
Very, very well. I've been really looking forward to this, too, ever since you first proposed it. So I think we're in for a special one this week.
Yeah, so you, if you follow, if you know who I am on Twitter, I guess, I am kind of quiet about that, but if we've crossed paths on some social medias, Facebook and whatnot, you may notice I follow a wonderful person named Bryson, who is Mi'kmaq. He's a ship's navigator. He's an educator. He's active in this community, and I'm really honored to call him my friend. And we're having him back on. If you've listened to Polytrex before, he was actually on the last episode I ever recorded with that. More to say there later in the news segments. But yeah, we welcome to the show Mr. Bryson. How are you doing today, Bryson?
I am doing very well. I'm excited to do this. Yeah, it's gonna be fun.
Yeah. So last time we met, we were talking about indigenous representation in Star Trek. And how do you feel about that? Just really quick off the top, like, have you noticed any change since we spoke, or
none at all?
Yeah. Like, it's, you know, they've gone in good other directions, but yeah.
Yeah. I kind of like, sometimes I'll do like the shade to like Star Trek and be like, you know, it's been 4,000 or 40,000 some odd days since no representation for indigenous people on Trek, and like, yeah, I just do stuff like that. Maybe somebody will see it.
We can hope. I mean, I think that is one thing about Star Trek, is if they're going to be putting their all their chips down on progressiveness and diversity, you know, they've done good jobs in other places and I commend them on that, but this is the next step, and addressing, you know, the colonial aspects as well of the Federation.
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah. Well, it's wonderful to have you back. I would say what's new, but I think that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. So perhaps we could move directly into the news there, Dan, unless there's anything else you wanted to weigh in on there.
No, absolutely. I think there's lots of good fodder for some great discussion later, because I'm excited to pick your brain, Bryson, about some stuff. And I'm really excited to learn a lot more. So this is going to be a lot of fun. But yeah, let's talk about the week's Star Trek news, which, you know, there isn't much, but there's a couple little news stories I highlighted here.
The first one is Star Trek Prodigy is nominated for Best Animated Children's Series, and that's in the Emmys. So Prodigy is potentially now a greater than zero chance of winning an Emmy, which I think it's well-deserved. This has been a fun show. I've enjoyed the episodes I've watched so far. It's whimsical. It's a good little piece of work there.
Yeah. Last time we spoke, you were talking about kind of catching up on them and stuff. I'm curious where you're at in that watch.
The very first episode. Oh, okay. I got about I got about 35 minutes through, and then we ended up getting a new cat.
Ah,
so that's taken precedent over keeping up with Prodigy at this point. But
that's understandable.
There is still time.
Yeah.
Bryson, have you watched any Prodigy?
Yes, right up until the last episode on Thursday. Yeah.
All right. So this is maybe a conversation between you and Dan, maybe a little more than. What do you guys think? How do you feel about this nomination?
It's well deserved, I think, because like it's just such a great show. Like it feels fresh.
Mm-hmm.
So fresh is in like it's kind of like it's got like stories that we may not have necessarily, you know, kind of looked at, or is it kind of more in its characterization?
Yeah, like in its characterization, like it has a different take. You know, like it is geared towards a younger crowd, but it doesn't shy away from heavy topics as well, you know? So like it kind of brings them to a level that younger people can understand.
Yeah, and I think it does a really good job of carrying on that Star Trek tradition of good messages. You know, I kind of credit watching TNG as a kid for some of, at least a good chunk of my morality and how I view the world and that sort of thing. And this show, I feel like it distills those down a little bit for a younger audience, but with still that same message, with that same heart to it. Like, Bryson, this most recent episode you mentioned, Let Sleeping Borg Lie.
Yeah.
And that one I felt had just a really strong message at the end about, you know, family and inclusiveness and belonging to a collective, I guess, in a roundabout way. I really liked that.
Yeah. And it also like dealt with PTSD and stuff like that. So like, you know, it was a great episode, I think. Like and it was very nostalgic because, you know, like it's the Borg. You know, everybody loves them and hates them at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, so I agree. Very well deserved nomination here. When I first saw this news story pop up, I was like, oh, a Star Trek Emmy nomination. So it'll be some technical thing or, oh, best children's animated series or whatever, right? Best animated children's series. That's great. I would love to see them win for like a creative award like that.
And especially a show in their first season.
Yeah, you know, like, no kidding.
Yeah.
It's something that I do feel a mild amount of embarrassment for not having kept up, but the way the two of you have both spoken about this, obviously, I am going to see if I can get some more familial watching with this, because I do think that this is it's pretty accessible too, would you guys say?
Yeah.
Very much so, yeah.
That's awesome.
The last few episodes, I've actually, when I watch them a second time, I've kind of tried to put myself in the mind of someone who's maybe a little younger, but also has never really watched Star Trek before. And so, for example, this most recent episode, being introduced to the Borg for the first time, I feel like the episode does a really great job of taking a lot of those Star Trek elements and saying, okay, this is what this is. Here's kind of the quick 10-minute lesson, and let's get into the story now. And yeah, I love it.
Yeah, and also they don't like dwell on the deep cuts. Like, you need to know this exact little, like, you know, moment from this episode of whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So like it kind of just has that like that deep cut, but it doesn't dwell on it.
Yeah, it's definitely there for the longtime fans. Like, there's enough stuff there for the seasoned fans among us, let's say, to pick up on and really appreciate, but it remains very accessible to the new viewer for sure. So yeah, the Children's and Family Emmy Awards, they'll be presented on Saturday, December 10th. Look forward to that and report here, I guess, if Prodigy can rack up a win for its first season.
It sounds pretty deserved.
I think so, for sure.
Yeah, I think so too.
Well, the other story, I think, is it's a trip into the uncanny valley, and I'll tell you about it in a second. And it's also something that, now I'm looking at it, there is a very, very high possibility that if my local comic book store brings a few in, I would potentially or even order one, because they're actually kind of cool. These Star Trek Super 7 Star Trek to the Next Generation Ultimate action figures with some real deep, like, speaking of deep cuts, like, you can like Riker, for instance, I was looking at his specifically, and you can change the type of hands he has. It comes with a trombone, it comes with a very bizarre tiny Picard plushie, and the best part that I like about it is, depending on what he's doing, you can change his face, and there's actually a few different facial features you can get for the different characters. My favorite also is Data's, that doesn't change at all, just there's some things coming out of one of his, and I think the other one he's wearing his visor or something like that, is his poker visor. They're very like articulate, and they're quite detailed. So yeah, you can change their face. They all come with like very little crazy like specific trinkets that come with them, and like companions, like Data comes with Spot. It's all very It's strange, but I like it.
Yeah, these are definitely something that caught my eye. Super 7 put out another line of TNG figures that were I didn't really get into them or look into them, but they were a lot less detailed and a little bit more kind of, not quite this accurate, I guess. So when I saw these come up, I was kind of thinking like, kind of more of the same. And then I clicked into them, and I'm pretty impressed with some of these things. And this first wave, I guess, this first offering, we have Riker, like you said, and Data, and also Guinan and Locutus, which is pretty cool. I think for myself, if I were going to pick any of these up, and I'm kind of maybe going to do that, I think I would want to get Guinan and Locutus, because I know me, and if I get Riker and Data, I would have to get the rest of the crew as they come out, and I don't know if I want to make that commitment. So, but yeah, these are pretty impressive. Guinan, you can even do like her crazy cat hands when she's confronting Q. Like, I love this.
Yeah.
Does the Riker one come with a little chair? So you can do the... And what about Angel One chest hair?
Oh, that needs to be like a variant figure that they put out.
Right?
I love it.
Oh. He does have one where it's like this like wry smile he's got on his face. So yeah, if you had the one where he's like wearing that like skimpy little, that little toga, that iridescent toga house coat that he's got with his chest hair and that wry smile, my goodness.
I'm good at sewing, so.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
I can modify.
That's awesome. They would have to put out a beardless one though, too, I think, for that one, which, I don't know. Riker without a beard just is wrong somehow.
Yeah
It's he's got a thin face without the beard. I like the beard better. It gives him that commanding look. I don't know, $55 American, I could justify one after some saving for sure.
Yeah Definitely.
They're kind of a nice medium between, you know, like the Playmates ones that are coming out, which are nice for their price. They're kind of in the $17 US range, somewhere in there. And then you've got like the $200 XO6 figures that, you know, that's a lot of money. $55 is still quite a bit too, though.
Yeah. Okay. So here's the question then. Would the two of you take the action figures out of the packaging and actually, like, you know, manipulate them, put them up and stuff? Myself, I would 100% do that and then, like, stand it up kind of near where my desk is or something like that. I would definitely take it out. What about you two?
Yeah, I'd definitely take it out.
Yeah, I would with these ones as well, too. I think they just have so much playability with the different heads and stuff, you know?
It's so weird. I wonder what hand you can almost see what hand he has in poker too. I should have had a better look.
Oh, it looks like a straight flush.
A straight flush. Of course, it's a straight flush.
Oh, actually.
Oh, and Data's got a hand in poker too.
Actually, would it be a royal flush? Actually,
why not? Oh goodness.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode of Positively Trek would not be possible without the support of those of you who have gone to patreon.com/positivelytrek and signed up to become a Patreon supporter of the show. Thank you all so very much for your donations. They truly do help bring this show to you each week. Thank you especially to our Constitution class supporters, Joyce Marin, Justin Ozer, Jim Stoffel, Jesse Earle, Dave Garcia, Rick Young, and Paul D. Kinnear. If you'd like to become a supporter of the show, go to patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can get perks such as early access to episodes, ad-free versions of episodes, exclusive content, shoutouts, associate producer credits, and much more. Once again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you all once again. And now, let's get back to the show.
I do have to say that getting to sort of experience Star Trek's many different facets has always been something I've enjoyed, and collecting is one thing, and making, you know, going to conventions we've talked about as well. But Bryson's done something I think is not only authentic, but also kind of organic. And it sort of has really given me a real feeling of Gene Roddenberry's vision, as would be said of like, it's Star Trek is kind of like, you know, being in the military or being out exploring or being, you know, kind of in some kind of organized Starfleet-y kind of thing. But like, obviously it doesn't really exist. And I have a bit of apprehension around, you know, the kind of the military aspect of Starfleet. The exploration aspect, however, is something really cool in the learning part. And so I find, Bryson, you've done this really cool job of uniting things that I've always loved. And that is Star Trek, that is exploration, indigenous culture, and Mr. Rogers. And I want to ask you, what initially compelled you to start sharing your experience, and what exactly are you taking again? I'm always forgetting the name of the course you're taking, and what's sort of like the end game you have in mind?
I'm taking marine navigation technology. Basically, it's just all the courses like that Transport Canada offers to eventually get your tickets, like your marine tickets, all in one program. Instead of doing, like most people used to do, self-studying, right? And do one course at a time. So like, yeah, this is just a more structured aspect of it. So like, when I get out, I will be writing my ticket to be a third mate. So that means I'll be the fourth person in command.
Wow, very cool.
Is that Data?
So fourth person in command?
Or would that be Dr. Crusher?
Yeah, possibly Dr. Crusher. I think Data was second officer, third in command.
Yeah, so that, yeah, you'd be basically, yeah, because I think Dr. Crusher, because she's a commander, would take the helm next, maybe. Anyways, this is the connection, Bryson. This is what I've been doing. Every time you show, you know, some schematic that you're working on, or like the outline drawing of a bulkhead, or you've got like just a ton of math, all I do is think of like, okay,
so
there he is
math.
In Stellar. Ugh, and math, my goodness. What scale of 1 to 10, how hard is this math, would you say, for yourself? Is math easy for you, or is this something that you've kind of had a natural?
It kind of is easy for me, but like this math I'm doing is, you know, it's three dimensional, you know, like it's astro navigation at its best, you know, like one calculation takes 45 minutes to do, you know, and you're using trigonometry, you're using, well, not only trigonometry, but spherical trigonometry. And it's hard to get your mind wrapped around that because you're traveling in a straight line, but you're not. You're actually traveling over the Earth, you know? So like it's so many variables. Yeah. And, you know, like math is, I'm good at math, but like, you know, like 1 + 1 = 2 is my favorite kind of math, not this stuff I'm doing, right? Yeah. So, you know, it's a lot. And like right now too, like I'm doing a cargo course right now. So we're learning about, I don't know, loading stuff and like how like stability. So you have to worry about like calculations with that, like, you know, like your center of gravities and stuff like that. So you don't tip over the ship.
So not only are you the crew of the Starship, you're also kind of the computer.
Yeah.
So I've got to ask, like in the middle of doing this kind of stuff, these crazy variables and calculations, do you ever kind of put yourself in the mind of being on a Starship? Like I'm a total nerd. So when I sit down to like a meeting in a meeting room, I'm like, oh, it's the briefing room. There's the window there and the stars are out there.
Yeah.
And I just kind of play that in my head. Does that ever happen to you?
Oh yeah. All the time. Cause like, especially because I'm a navigator at heart. Right. So like that's what I would be doing on a Starship. You know, I'd probably be a navigator.
So yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
it is kind of like, you know, in our sort of imaginary Trek world, you are the closest analog we have,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like to Starfleet, in the sense that you do all these like complicated things and it is very much based on, you know, if you were traveling through space. I mean, even our understanding of space is actually warped, right? It like space is kind of like the size, like the shape of a saddle or something. They say the universe is kind of and here you are, you know, that is right, where, you know, you understand why the Mercator's map kind of inflates the size of everything at its poles. It's so that you can move in a straight line on a map without having to arc it so crazily.
It's just, there's just so many similarities, but it's like, it feels like it's like ancient technology at the same time, you know, compared to like Star Trek technology.
Well, exactly. But you have even more of a connection too, right? You've served on a tall ship too.
Yeah. And fun fact about that is I worked on the Lady Washington.
What?
Oh,
which
wow.
is the Enterprise.
Yeah. From Generations, right? That was the
yeah,
ship.
I worked on her. Yeah.
That is too cool.
Back in, when was that? 2005. Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was the Lady Washington. What the hell?
Yeah, yeah.
Why are you so cool, Bryson? This isn't fair.
I'm not really cool in real life. No.
I beg to differ, I think.
So I just do a what lot did of you mundane do? Things, little thing. Oh, on...
Okay,
on,
yeah, ooh. On yeah. the Lady Washington, what mundane things did you get up to, sir? I want to know every detail now. This is going to be a 3-hour episode, by the way. I'm canceling my plan.
Well, you know, like I worked in California, so I worked on a bunch of different ships there. You know, got to do like a week or two on these ships. But I'm like, my main one was in San Pedro. I worked on that, the Irving Johnson. So... But like I got to go on for a week on the Lady Washington, you know, have fun. We did cannon battles, you know, we did lots of touring of the ship, you know, like sitting at the dock being like, don't trip over that. And then they would trip over that. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, just stuff like that. Cool little, like, you know, we went down to San Diego and stuff like that. So, yeah.
What sort of duties did you have on the tall ships? Where did you find yourself mostly?
I was a deckhand, so I basically was like the lowest rank. So I did everything, like
nice
lower decks,
paint. Yeah, basically, yeah. That's where I spent most of my time, in the lower decks. You know, like I on one ship, I slept in a room with 18 other people. Yeah. So it was, yeah. And we ate there, you know, we socialized in that spot. We had bunks that were 3 feet by 3 feet by 6 feet, you know.
Wow. Yeah.
I spent most of my life in a bunk that big.
I mean, like my favorite, one of my favorite episodes of Star Trek is Master and Commander on the Far Side of the Ocean, or Far Side of the World. And I mean, like, there are moments and times where like my historical knowledge can, you know, be like, well, this would have been this way and that would have been that way. And, oh, they're doing this for effect or whatever else. But I'm just thinking to myself now that you could totally be looking at the, you know, what they're doing, you know, say they're tying a knot or say they're moving somewhere else. And you'd be like, oh, that would kill him. No, that wouldn't happen. Oh, his fingers would fly right off. Like, do you do that as well? Like when you're watching stuff like that?
Oh yes. I'm like, this is not accurate. There's like, I'm like, this is wrong. They shouldn't be pulling this line. I'm like, oh, look, there's a radar covered by canvas. Yeah. That's not accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I nitpick like sailing movies all the time. Yeah.
Which one would you say is one of the more accurate you've watched?
White Squall is pretty accurate because they've used a tall ship. And surprisingly, Pirates of the Caribbean is pretty accurate. Like they have one of like the most accurate like depictions of club hauling in all of movie history, I think. Club hauling it's basically you drop your anchor while you're sailing and pivot around it and then break it off and go. Yeah, that's like the coolest scene in all of Pirates, I think.
So how do you feel about like when Star Trek kind of brings in a lot of those like nautical terms for like flavor and stuff? Like I'm thinking of Star Trek VI, right? Where Kirk's like right standard rudder, bring us alongside, that kind of thing. And, you know, even Janeway saying like batten down the hatches. And does that ring true for you? Or is that like, oh, they're kind of putting something on here?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, you know, like it's kind of like, hey, I know what they're saying. or like, I'll be like, oh, wait, actually, I gotta see if they're actually using that correctly and, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, it's, you know, it is kind of, sometimes it is over the top. You're like, okay, you had a writer in that day, didn't you?
Yeah. Or Nick Meyer was heavily influenced on this one. Yeah. Yeah.
So to kind of pivot into a specific here, you did something very, very cool earlier this year. And I think it's something that really kind of tickled the Picard vibe a lot in terms of what you were up to, and something that I think the actual Enterprise would do on a more galactic scale. Can you tell us what you got up to this summer?
Yeah, I was a deckhand on a ship that went out to the Titanic. Yeah. And we took tourists down to the Titanic in a submersible. I didn't go down personally. I would have loved to. But yeah, we did 5 trips out there. So a good 6 weeks we were out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, you know, at the wreck site. And yeah, it was very moving moment to be in.
Did you have much of a fascination with the Titanic beforehand, or?
Oh yes. Yeah. Like, it's what got me into wanting to be a sailor, you know, 'cause like I was 6 years old when they found the Titanic, and, you know, I was in that impressionable mindset that, you know, like, this is cool. Like, you know, I want to be an explorer, you know? So, and it was cool too, because like, I keep saying cool. I don't know why. but it was awesome. Yeah. You know, like, it's so mind blowing, you know, like I got to meet actual people that were like there when the Titanic was found, you know, like our head, you know, submersible driver was working as a young person on the Nateel. So it's pretty cool. And he dove down to the Titanic 38 times. There's a picture of, you know, just after they found, they're on the deck of the what's the Woods Hole boat. Anyway, I'm terrible with boat names. Yeah, and they're all there, and they have the Explorer Club's flag up, right? And we actually had that with us.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was very. It was once in a lifetime thing. You know, it was my pinnacle, I think.
I gotta say, man, like, it really is pretty darn cool. Like, we're all saying this word over and over again because I think we're at a loss. Like, you're right. There's a ton of intersecting history, right?
Yeah.
Just like starting at the top, right? There is this new trip, which I wouldn't mind actually asking after I'm done kind of explaining this out, what exactly the trip might be about. But then, yeah, like, here you are meeting people who were either present or had something to do with the initial discovery of the Titanic. Then you're like literally over top of what is, I think, you know, one of the most fundamental historical events in the Western world, at least. So, you know, there's all of that. And all of that history that's just sort of swirling around, plus, you know, your own personal history, like you said, like, I agree, that is a once in a lifetime event. And I really, really appreciate that you took us all along, and the pictures you took, and all the different little things. It actually kind of like helped my mental health out a little bit, just getting to kind of vicariously sort of sit on your shoulder and watch the whole thing unfold.
Yeah, you know, like, that's why I kind of like tried to like live tweet it as much as possible, because, like, you know, it was just such a phenomenal moment, you know, and humbling at the same time, you know, like, to be out there where 1500 people passed away, you know, to be looking at images of shoes on the bottom of that's somebody, you know. So, like, yeah, it was I cried a lot, you know.
yeah
as I think many of us would, but wow, to be there, and like you say, especially that personal connection, that's what led you to be in the position to be able to be there, was that fascination with that initial. That's amazing. What a story.
One of the most one thing that actually kind of gave me a moment of pause, and I've gone back to it a few times, is the picture you took while you were anchored, I think, over the Titanic site, and there was like a carrier ship or something out in the distance, and you took a picture, because that would, like, relatively speaking, be pretty close to, I think it would have been the Carpathia that passed by.
Oh, no, the that would be the California.
The California. Yeah, and just the running lights, seeing those in the distance, and, like, thinking again about those people who were like either waiting in the water and seeing those lights off in the distance, it was particularly haunting, but also, yeah, cool too at the same time.
You know, there was moments like, I remember our first night there, like I think it was just after I took that photo, I was just standing there on the aft deck and looking up the sky, and just a meteorite just went by and it was just bright green. And I literally was the only one that seen it. And I was like, oh, like, this is why I'm out here. You know, it was like, these are the moments, you know, that this is what I do. And like, it's the coolest job in the world.
I agree.
Amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love my job too, but.
Or like, there's a moment where, you know, like I'm touching this submersible for the first time. And I'm like, harking back to like first contact, you know, when Picard is touching the Phoenix.
I love this because of, you know, there's the exploration, there's those vibes as well, but also like, just speaking as someone who was born and raised and currently once again lives in the prairies in Canada, like this is so far removed from my experience. Like the comedian Ron James might say, you know, we have waves of wheat. That's the closest we have, but they won't pull you down into a prairie undertow because that's not our experience at all. So I'm amazed and just in awe. And I love this picture you're painting because, there's something, I don't know, fundamental or something, the experience you're painting here, like it touches something primal in human beings, I think. Being alone out there on this vast wilderness that's the ocean, right? And I don't know. I'm getting chills and I can't articulate it exactly.
Yeah, yeah. No, I totally agree. Like it's awesome. You know, like for every bad day I have out there, you know, I have thousands of great days. Nobody ever wants to hear about the great days. So like, that's why, like, I felt like I should be tweeting on the great days, because, you know, you need to know like the whole story.
So what would you say the big, like, what kind of stood out to you in terms of the response to all of this? I mean, I was standing at the sideline. I didn't comment all the time or anything like that, but there were some pretty excited people for what you did there.
And
So what would you say like stood out? Was there anything, any connections that you made through sharing all of that, that you'd want to share?
I feel like on my Twitter, I've made a really good community, but like what I was doing, like tweeting about the Titanic and stuff like that, really brought in a lot of like people that have similar connections to it, you know, and that I never knew, you know, and I've been following a lot of people for years, and like, they were like, oh, this reminds me of my father and, you know, stuff like that. So it was all those good memories, you know, like that people were sharing that I was like, oh, wow. You know, like I'm helping them to like remember these good times.
Well, the vibe I got from you was very Mr. Rogers, and I hope you take that as a compliment. He's someone who really helped me when I was young to get to know the world without always being able to get to those places. As Dan said, we are way the heck and gone from any ocean here. Either you're climbing mountains or you're walking forever. And honestly, if I was going to try to get to an ocean from here, I'd probably go the mountain way because it's prettier, but maybe north would be faster. I don't know. Just follow the river. Anyways, you know, with Mr. Rogers, he was always able to kind of, in a very calm and friendly way, and you could tell he enjoyed what he did, but there was just a manner he had about him that I don't know if it was intentional or not, you sort of took on, where sometimes you'd address the people watching, you know, do you know what this is, or do you know what this does, and then other times, you know, you would just show a picture of the wake you were cutting, right, with the sound. And it was really, I found that like ASMR style, just nice to hear the sound of the wind and the water and everything else. There was, with Mr. Rogers, there was, I guess, like the best term I could use is a casual intentionality to the whole thing, if that makes any sense.
It does. It makes so much sense, you know, because like he taught you without teaching you. That's how I take away from Mr. Rogers, you know, like, there was always lessons he was teaching, you know, and like, and that's how I feel, like, you know, like I'm here on this earth to teach. And then when I can't, you know, like I'm done, you know, like I've done what I needed to do. So like, you know, like I enjoy sharing like the little details, you know, like, oh, you know, what's the name of this knot? You know, like people actually want to learn stuff like that, you know, or like, you know, what's the function of this random thing on deck? You know, I guess like in my industry, like there's such a like niche of people, like, you know, like it's, there's not that much people that does what I do, you know, especially for you guys, you know, like you don't grow up around the water, you know, like I've been around the water since I was born. So it's a different breed, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it really does kind of do that same thing that Star Trek does. And I love how you've managed to sort of marry all of these things together. But I feel like I've been jabbering too much here, Dan. I'm going to let you weigh in.
Your job as a navigator. So how much of kind of what you do would look familiar to a Star Trek fan? Like if you're on the bridge doing your thing, or what would that look like to someone who knows nothing about seafaring but grew up on Star Trek? Me, maybe.
Well, the modern ships I work on right now, like they're so computerized. I can literally press a button and it will take me straight to it, you know, where I need to go.
So it's literally like Chekhov's, like course plotted and laden, captain.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, like we don't have big ship's wheel. It's like literally a joystick. So it's crazy how like similarities. Like I don't know if you guys saw, like, but I did tweet like a picture of the bridge, and it's just so futuristic. It looks like a starship bridge. You know, like there's computer screens everywhere. There's touch buttons, and like, yeah, it's amazing.
And the next time you go, you'll go in your uniform, right? Your Starfleet uniform.
Yeah.
Get a selfie on the bridge.
Yeah. Because I didn't have time to like work on actual, like do any of the navigation this summer, because I was literally stuck in a small boat on the middle of the Atlantic for 5 weeks, you know? So I never got a chance to be up on the bridge for more than like 10 minutes, you know, definitely next year.
So the other question I have is, how is the food?
Oh my God. Well, you know, like when we had three different clients on this summer. So like, you know, we had the Titanic, then we did a couple survey trips on the Titanic. Yeah. We ate a lot of good food. Yeah. The budget was not spared, you know? And normally like when I work on ships, I lose weight. No, not this year. I gained weight. Yeah. So that, yeah, the food was great.
I often think about like when things got good or when things got bad, say like in Star Trek, obviously they've always had the replicator or just sort of the inexplicable amount of food that would be allowed. But I think about like Enterprise and stuff like that, and Neelix cooking as well, right? And like stores of food and everything like that. What would you say is like, is there like a ship's food go-to that say us land lovers wouldn't really know about? Or is my grandpa was a merchant marine and he always talked about peanut butter and honey toast.
Well, not so much on this ship, but like on tall ships, you know, like we do bare bone trips. So like everything's like calculated right down to the T. So like, you know, on long voyages, you run out of things and you'll be like, ah, oh, I really want that. But literally we're out of the middle Atlantic. We can't go to the grocery store. So like I Nutella was a big thing on one ship I worked on, you know, like people would buy it and like stash it in their bunks and be like, this is my private stash. And like junk food would be, you know, the currency on some ships, you know. You trade things for junk food.
I've done a little bit of research on like pirates and stuff like that, and I found that like the way certain privateers, I guess as they would call themselves, really the captain only had power, like unquestionable power during like a storm or combat. Otherwise, everything else was relatively democratic. I don't know if this is accurate or not, but did you find that on the tall ships that you were on as well? It kind of followed those kind of more democratic rules or?
Yeah. Like, you know, like even us deckhands had a say, you know, because like we ran the ship pretty much, you know, so like. But like the day-to-day operation, like the bigger picture was always the captain and first mate and stuff like that. So
the last piece about this before, if we're going to kind of keep on this, I don't know if we're following the entire thing here, but or the plan ahead. But one piece is, you know, obviously with the Federation being the kind of sci-fi analog to seafarers and explorers and everything. It isn't the only version of that. And you yourself are Mi'kmaq, and of course Mi'kmaq people are a seafaring people as well. So maybe just we could kind of round the discussion in that direction as well, of talking about, you know, your indigenous heritage and how that plays a part in your desire to, you know, obviously go out into the ocean and stuff like that and explore and see around and stuff. Because obviously where you are is in so-called Canada, so-called Nova Scotia. Obviously, Mi'kmaq people have been there for considerably longer, traveling the seas, navigating around and stuff like that. So is there any connection you feel in that regard? Or, I mean, that's a loaded question. Of course you do. But what is the connection, and how do you feel that?
Mi'kmaq, as Mi'kmaq people, we've been seafarers, you know, forever. You know, we've traveled in canoes everywhere, you know. So, like, I have that huge, like, deep connection with the waters, especially the waters here in the Maritimes, you know. Like, our people grew up here. So, like, it feels natural, you know, to be a sailor. Even though, like, nobody in my family has ever sailed, you know, the closest we got, we were like, my family's history is like, you know, like, we made mast hoops for ships, you know, like the Blue Nose and all those Grand Banks schooners.
Wow. So you have relatives who worked on those kinds of ships, eh?
Yeah.
Wow, that's really cool. And then going further back, like, and just for clarification to, again, our prairie and non-ocean faring listeners, when Bryson says canoes, he doesn't mean the size of like a canoe that we would see at Canadian Tire. Mi'kmaq canoes are pretty hefty, hey?
Yeah, like ours, you know, they could be built up to 30 feet, you know, and had sails, and, you know, were built to cross ocean, or not oceans, but, you know, like, cross the Northumberland Strait, or like even the Cabot Strait here to, you know, go to Newfoundland.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think is fascinating is there is, like, both in terms of oral history, but also archaeological evidence that, yeah, Mi'kmaq people traded and made connections with the Beatuk and other groups of people as well, which is, again, just a testament to their sophistication. So, I mean, obviously they would have had a certain level of mental math, stellar cartography to make trips of that distance successful as well, which, again, super sophisticated and cool. Is there a fairly strong representation of Mi'kmaq people working in kind of your line of work, or are you?
Not really. Like, I've only ran into a few of us. Like, mostly they're like, all my relatives are fishermen. So like, being out in the commercial industry is not really a desired aspect. And, you know, like, it is kind of like morally conflicting too, because the ships I'm working on right now are linked with the oil fields and the oil rigs and, you know, and stuff like that. So, like, you know, the pipelines and such. So, like, you know, it's kind of like a moral dilemma, but, you know, like, at the same time, you can compartmentalize that, you know, because you do have to make a living. And I rather, like, personally, I rather see these oil rigs and platforms working at their best optimal, like, efficiency and not having problems, not spilling thousands and thousands of tons of oil, you know, if they do have an emergency. So, you know, like, you got to justify it like that.
I get that, living and working in Alberta. And I think, Barry, when you and I first met, I was actually employed by one of the big oil and gas companies, which I distinctly remember you asking me, like, oh, what do you do? And I kind of went, well, but, you know, I was one of the trainers and stuff. So I did the same thing, right? You compartmentalize it. You want people to be safe and you want them to be healthy. And so I saw myself as kind of fulfilling that role a bit. So I understand that kind of trepidation and a little bit of morally gray areas and navigating this modern world that we find ourselves in.
Yeah. And, you know, like, the company I work for, they're very, like, pro-Indigenous. And they actually have a subsidiary company that is all run by Indigenous people. And they're hoping, like, in the next couple of years, they're going to have all Indigenous crews on their boats. So, like, you know, I'm happy to, to like actually start doing that, you know, and helping them with that.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah.
Well, I think the key to sustainability is in learning lessons from Indigenous cultures and societies. I think that, I don't know, I don't want to get like too polytrexy here, but like obviously there's mitigating circumstances. You're right. People have to eat. And I think about all of the things we do, we need to do what we can in the places we have, you know, in terms of like educating people. I think that's something the three of us all share. We all educate in our own ways. And that's really important. And I mean, in my line of work as an educator, you know, I talk with a lot of students whose parents are also working in the oil field and stuff like that. And understanding that, you know, human caused climate change is definitely something that the oil field and oil and gas is culpable for in so many ways. But if we were to suddenly decide immediately tomorrow to change everything, it doesn't mean that we wouldn't be using oil and gas. We'd just be using it less commercially, less based on profit, and more geared towards sustainability. So I think in all of our three specific magisteria, this is a good spot for us to all be at. I'm really happy to hear that this company you're working for does prioritize a certain amount of Indigenous leadership and representation, because I think the more exposure that is there, I think the less we can be so hell-bent on profit and thinking more about the investments that we can make in terms of like having a planet to live on and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, like and with like the shipping industry too, like, you know, like it's still one of the most less producers of carbon than any other industry, you know. And also like we're in the midst of like a huge revolution, like with shipping, like, you know, like where they're going back to sails, they're going back to like all these amazing technologies, you know, like salt reactors, you know, hydrogen salt reactors, that instead of using fuels, you know, like they're using hydrogen technology, you know. So it's awesome, like to be on the cusp of a revolution, you know, for the industry.
I've seen those schematics of ships, and I don't very out of context, very just, you know, single thing put together in a meme, but it was a ship with kind of these big like tubes coming up or something, and they said they're powered by the wind, and of course the meme was ships powered by the wind, wow, it's the future. It's like, that's pretty great.
yeah those are what are they called? I think Fetner like rotor sails. Yeah. And they're pretty cool technology, but they've been around since like 1919.
Wow.
Like,
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're making a big comeback right now.
Oh, amazing. So I was kind of curious, just in your own personal life, I always like to ask this of people who are Star Trek fans. When did you become a Star Trek fan, and what drew you to it? What's your kind of earliest memory of liking this thing called Star Trek?
Oh, well, you know, I grew up in the age of the Next Generation. Yeah. So like, I was young, you know. When did it come out?
87.
Yeah. I would have been 6 years old, you know? So I don't really remember it, but I definitely remember it from like reruns and like, you know, like I watched it live, you know, like season finale or a series finale, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, you know, I'm a 80s and 90s kid. So there's a lot of parallels with, you know, like with Star Trek and like what I do in the real world. So like, you know, it's pretty cool.
We kind of started the conversation way back when talking about Indigenous representation in Star Trek, and I'm curious your perspective a little bit, because speaking for myself, I'm Métis on my mom's side. And, you know, I first remember when they announced Star Trek Voyager was coming, and, you know, the first officer was going to be in the language of Hollywood at the time, and still unfortunately now, an Indian, you know, there's, you know, and all of this. And I remember being so excited at the time that, you know, someone who looks like my uncles and my grandpa and stuff is going to be on the show. And I mean, we can talk about where my feelings went after that character was introduced and the things they did. But I'm curious your perspective, kind of seeing that in Star Trek and I guess maybe kind of going with what Barry's been doing this last week, do you have kind of a report card for Star Trek on their indigenous representation?
Oh, yes, yes, for sure. Like, I feel like I'm like yelling into the void sometimes on like on Trek Twitter, because like, you know, like I'm always talking about indigenous representation in Star Trek, you know, like how it's not been like the greatest. It's been very Hollywood stereotypical representation. So, and a lot of the context was written by non-indigenous people. So, you know, like there's a lot of wrongs that need to be righted in Star Trek. And like, I'm one of those people, like, I'm so sick of like aliens always giving technology to native people, you know, yes. Like we see it in Ancient Aliens all the time, you know, the guy with the meme.
And the aliens are always white guys too. Like, let's be honest.
Yeah. So yeah, I always talk about how like it needs to be like, there needs to be a new character, you know, they have to bring in a character that's actually fleshed out and like from places, you know, because like all of the white characters, they have these complex backstories. Like, you know, friggin' Janeway hates thunderstorms because she grew up in Iowa. And then you get, you know, Chakotay, where he's like, yeah, I grew up in the Amazon and blah 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 blah, and I can't make fire with sticks, you know. And you're just like, great, that's the representation that I have.
Yeah, and every time they do something with it, you hear the pan flutes come out, and yeah. It's just like, okay, yeah. All right.
Yeah, I think like the most, for me, and I mean, this is a big one, but I think Russell Bates's animated series episode, How Sharp a Serpent's Tooth, probably has the most strongest representation, and it's minimal. Like, I think it's is it Lieutenant Walking Bear, I think was his
yeah.
name.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that's it. Like, it's probably the least watched bit of Star Trek of all. It's probably the least watchable of all series as well.
Yeah.
I missed the animated series. It doesn't do much for me. I used to watch Hercules. Remember, you guys remember Hercules in the back?
Yeah.
Very similar animation style, when all the monsters either went rah rah or
yeah.
Again, as like a settler, I never noticed. And yeah, by the time Voyager comes along, I was like, oh, well, there's our representation, and just kind of odiotin-dotin-dayed my way along it. And until social media, I think to some degree, I never really fully knew that there was even an issue there. And I think that's maybe Star Trek's biggest blind spot, is the Federation. And, you know, the way they make fun of it with the Borg is actually a colonial power and has the ability to affect indigenous communities. Right? I mean, like the Prime Directive, right, is basically their Band-Aid for the crimes of earthbound colonialism and stuff like that. And I don't know, I guess like I've got my ideas and stuff like that, but I wonder if just the way they've structured Star Trek altogether, even though they've made so many advancements in representing people, especially by breaking down the myth of gender and stuff like that. Maybe from your guys' perspective, you know, if you could make an indigenous character, or you could make something, an arc or something that would be able to tackle the heavy issues that Star Trek tackles, but, you know, in more of like a way that... that indigenous people face, is there, and not to put you on the spot, but like, is there anything that we could even say, you know, would be what you'd be looking for, or what you, if you could be given the writer's task, what would you want to make? Who would you want to make?
Well, for me, like, I really want to address like how bad did Earth get that all the natives had to move off world?
Yeah.
You know?
Actually, yeah.
Like, that's a huge, like, unanswered question. You know, like they literally left and went to a different world, and they were on that world for centuries, you know. So like, what the heck? That's what I really want to address. Like, why was it so bad that native people needed to leave?
It's actually a funny, I was just talking with my wife Nikki today about Deep Space Nine, and we watched it all through a few years ago, her first time. And I was like, oh, we should rewatch that again and start at the beginning now that you know all the characters and stuff. And I started thinking about one of my favorite scenes in the premiere episode of Deep Space Nine, where Bashir is all wide-eyed and excited and he's stalking the infirmary and he says, "Oh, this is where heroes are made, right here in the wilderness. This is frontier medicine." And Kira gets right in his face and says, "This wilderness is my home." And she says, "You know, you can help by bringing your Federation medicine to the natives. You'll find them a friendly, spiritual folk," or something like that. And I love that scene. And it's really something that, like, I wish they played with more as Deep Space Nine went by. I mean, the station is called Deep Space Nine. Like, how insensitive is that?
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, colonialism on Star Trek. Oh, my goodness. And then, yeah, they kind of didn't really do much with that after that.
Yeah, yeah. The colonialism doesn't have to be addressed. And, like, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, know how to describe it. But yeah, I guess that's the big thing I really want to address. And like, what happened afterwards? Because like, I don't know, I just do that whole like, you know, calculation meme thing in my head. Because like, you know, at the last time we seen that colony, they were fighting with the Cardassians. And then you skip over to Voyager and I forget which season they were in. I think just after they reconnected with Starfleet. You know, like they said that all Maquis like colonies were destroyed. So does that mean like the planet of Indians is destroyed? You know, like, are they extinct? Like, you know, that needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
Also, Sisko annihilated the atmosphere of a planet because he got pissed off by Eddington. And I mean, maybe some of those people were there too. Like, and did they have time to evacuate? Like, there is sometimes where the way in which it, I mean, obviously it's stronger in the TOS and the earlier ones, and it's, I think they're getting to a place where they can approach it a little bit better. I just feel like the recent like discovery, like where would they best be able to explore the concepts around indigeneity? I really felt like they could have almost done it with their storyline around Saru, but it never got approached. But I do think also like indigenous people should be the ones writing those stories ultimately when it comes time, because settlers just aren't good at it. We write our own stories and sometimes they forget tons of people. But but Dan, on your end, like where would you want to see that? You know, like we haven't talked at length about, you know, kind of, or at least recently, you know, about this sort of specific context, but where would you want to see Trek go?
I mean, yeah, just kind of even just giving us a character who's just a character who has like Bryson was saying earlier, like you were saying, a fully fleshed out backstory that isn't tropey, isn't tokenist and all that kind of stuff. And after seeing Discovery Season 4, let's have Michael Grey Eyes play him. He was incredible. Like, there's no shortage of talented, amazing Indigenous performers to choose from either, you know? Like, I think of Stamets and Culber and how they're allowed to just exist as themselves. And the fact that they're a same-sex couple doesn't play into the story. Like, you could, In a lot of cases, scenes with them together, their gender does not matter. It's a loving couple existing. I want to see that. I want to see people existing as people without having to have twee pan flute music playing and them having to go on a vision quest and do things that have very little resemblance to the real lived reality that people live, you know?
Yeah, and if I hear Coochie Moya one more time...
Oh man, I was talking with a student of mine who's Indigenous and has a bit more interest in Star Trek, and we were talking about the what your warp, like let's go to warp sort of, you know, engage in, and theirs was Skoden, which I thought was really funny.
Nice.
Yeah, which I some of us may not have seen Reservoir Dogs. If you haven't, please do. It's a delightful and also really like good. Really heavy in some cases, a TV show that doesn't have much to do with Star Trek, but I've noticed they've made Bigfoot references every episode almost, and I think that's pretty cool. So I was going to ask, like, this is, again, I'm just moving into the woo land here. You've been on the ocean a lot. Have you ever seen anything weird out there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, tons of weird things. You know, like, you know, on this trip, like we had just like random fishing gear just go by us, like that were probably jettisoned from or like broke free from the ship, you know, like, and it was all set, you know, like it was long line, like I'm guessing for swordfish. So like it was just floated by us, like, you know, or like, I know, I remember one time, like we're sailing through fog, like on a tall ship I worked on, and out of the fog, I'm just like staring at this thing and like a life raft comes out of the fog, you know, and it was like discolored. It was half inflated. You know, there's stuff growing on the bottom of it. So it was out there for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's eerie.
Yeah. So like, and like, obviously there was nobody in it, right? You know, like it was, yeah, it was weird. So it just floated by us.
Anomalies.
Yeah.
It's your anomalies.
Right? Yeah.
We've detected an anomaly off of.
No tears in the space-time continuum though, eh?
No, no, not yet. And another thing is like my catchphrase, which I could say on for Star Trek is Boosinage. Which means in Mi'kmaq, that means let us take a journey together across the sea in a canoe.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. Speaking of sophistication, can you say that again?
What? Boosinage?
Boosinage.
Yeah.
Wow.
I love
so it.
So
it means to go on a journey together across the sea in a canoe.
Yeah.
It's even got a, it's got a kinetic quality, like the word itself, yeah, as well. Like it sounds like a let's give her, let's go. I love it.
Yeah,
that's great.
Nice. Yeah, I've been learning a little bit of Cree. My fiance is Cree Métis and her family speaks Cree, so I've been picking up little bits and stuff, and I found that there actually is like a word for the man walked up the hill with a cane. So yeah, very sophisticated, expressive,
yeah,
kind of language. I think that's the other little piece that I was going to say is, you know, like while you're out there, you know, have you been learning any, have you learned any Mi'kmaq tradition around seafaring? Has any survived? Because I hate to ask that question, but colonial societies and all that, right?
Yeah. There's some, like, I have an old school, like, Mi'kmaq dictionary, you know, like a paper one, and it has a lot of sailing terms in it, you know, like it, you know, like, I don't really know what they are because like it's written in a dialect I don't know, but I know the gist of the word. I it's not properly spelt from my understanding of the language, which is a little bit. But yeah, there's tons of sailing words in this dictionary, like, you know, port, starboard, you know, helm, everything.
Yeah, I've been I made a promise a long time ago that I would learn Cree, and I've been very, very slow going, and I need to just kind of do it. The one thing that sticks in my mind right now, and this is apropos of nothing, is that Tacoma means snot. So I will never, ever drive a Toyota Tacoma. That's all I see now when I see those vehicles.
And like a hard thing for me, like Mi'kmaq is like, it's so, there's so much subtlety into it. Like just even how you say something, it, if you change like where the pause is, it totally changes the, what you're saying, you know, like you, there's one word, it's Gesalu, which means I love you. But if you say it with, how do you say it? I think it's Gesalu. It means I'm going to throw you gently into a fire. You know, so like,
wow,
my language is complicated because like, you know, even the cadence of how you say things, you know, like is going to screw something up.
Really?
Yeah.
I do love that it's gently though. Like that's.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know how I can picture how to throw something gently into a fire, but yeah, it sounds pretty cool.
I get images of a very sort of like determined but calm, just pushing.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Well, this has been a fantastic discussion that I am trying to keep to our time limits here, but Bryson, we'd love to have you back on anytime. And if you aren't following Bryson, where Bryson can people find you to live vicariously and through your trips, learn more about Mi'kmaq society, and get the learning? Where can they find you?
Well, on almost all of my social medias, I'm known as Bryson the Gative.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's how you can find me.
Bryson the Gative. And yeah. So that's a portmanteau of being a gay native.
Yeah.
Awesome. Love it.
Perfect.
And I highly recommend you look for Bryson. He is a load of fun. His cats are amazing. It's always fun, and he's always showing us pictures of McMoggy, which is always beautiful to see. Well, where can they find you, Mr. Dan?
You can find me for now on Twitter at Kertrats, that's Kertrats, and of course in the Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook, where if I'm not posting a lot, I'm at least lurking, so keeping up to date on all the discussions happening there. And of course, Positively Trek on Twitter, just at Positively Trek, you'll find us there.
You can find me on Facebook just at Barry DeFord. Otherwise, I do also tend to lurk around. I did a lot more lurking recently on Positively Trek. So once again, hoping to do a little more there. And basically, that's where you'll find me on the social medias. And once we figure out Twitter, I'll tell you where you can find me then. Thank you, everyone, for listening. And as we always say here, stay positive.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.